Hey everybody, Jonathan Dorr with you once again. Welcome back to the Catholic Teacher Podcast. As always, great to have the privilege and the pleasure of your company on our journey together in this great big adventure of Catholic education. Look, I hope you've enjoyed recent weeks. We had great interview with Dr. Greg Bataro. We've had Dr. Paul Morrissey last week. If you haven't heard these, check them out on Apple Podcasts, wherever you're hearing it, because we've really had some great guests on. Housekeeping from me, would you please subscribe to the podcast? Wherever you're hearing this, would you please just subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Android, Google Play, wherever you're hearing it. I'd love you to subscribe. Leave a comment in Apple or Android so you can give us some feedback. But subscribing to the podcast makes it easy for us just to grow the reach of what we're doing, and also just make sure you don't miss any episodes in the time ahead. Also, please, there'll be links to check out the free trial to the Going Deeper program. If you're not using that, please take the free trial. 4 weeks, amazing, incredible Catholic teacher inspiration, motivation, formation program being used by over 400 Catholic schools around the world. So check out that free trial of the Going Deeper program. You're going to find out all about it, see how it could work in your school. I'd love you to come and join us, so check that out. Also, if you use Facebook, I know some of you don't, but if you do use Facebook, please come and check out the link to our private group. We have about almost 1,000 people now in the Passionate Catholic Teachers private Facebook group. I'd love you to come and join us there so we can share some more great content with you. All right, that's it. Let's begin. This was fun. This was one of the most enjoyable podcasts I've got to do in a long time, with one of God's very special people. She is one of my favorite humans. She's somebody that brings a great deal of sunshine and joy to the world. She's a great blessing to many, many people. And as you're going to hear in this podcast, she's really an example of what's really the best about Catholic education. My guest today is the wonderful Rose Pillay. She's with Catholic Education in the Archdiocese of Vancouver. I had the pleasure of meeting Rose last year in person when I flew there to do the keynote for their conference, and a really memorable first meeting, as Rose will remember, and just a wonderful encounter. So she's going to share with us today her journey in Catholic education, her background, her family story, and she's going to share so much more. So I really hope you enjoy this very special interview today with my good friend and guest, Rose Pillay. Rose Pillay, thank you so much for making time for the Catholic Teacher Podcast.
Thank you, Jonathan, for having me. I am super excited to be here with you.
It's going to be awesome. I liked how yesterday we were talking on Twitter and you're like, I wonder if we could do this podcast via GIFs. I know there'll be plenty of listeners that don't know the beauty, the power, the magnificence of the Twitter GIF. So,
but Jonathan, you actually created the monster in me, though. When I had first reached out to you for the Catholic Educators Conference through direct messaging through Twitter, I didn't realize the power of GIFs until you brought me into that world. And now in these parts, I'm known as the GIF queen here. So,
it's so good. I'm hoping on my tombstone, there'll be something more than just that. But it'll be like, faithful son of the church who took gifts to a whole new level. So, look, it's been so good to connect with you over the last, I guess, sort of 18 months or so, and then to meet you in person in Vancouver. You know, you're one of the
Can I correct you? You didn't just meet me in person. You surprised me in person in Vancouver.
I remember that.
That was a moment, my friend, that you and Patrick were awesome to me. So remember it.
You're one of the absolute joys of Catholic education, and we're going to talk about joy in this interview. Look, there was something in your notes, and the notes that many of the listeners probably don't know, that we put a few questions out there for the guests that come on, and your responses are fantastic. I just went back through them again this morning.
Thank you.
And I'm going to share those with people. But look, the first question we often ask is, what led into your vocation? I want to read this to people because it's great. It says, in my post-baccalaureate year, I wanted to be a medical genetics counselor, but during an advanced cytogenetics class presentation in which I had created paper bag chromosomes to explain a genetic abnormality, my professor asked, why had I not thought to become a teacher? Was that the moment for you?
That was the moment. And I guess when I approached that class and we had the last opportunity to teach one of those seminars, I myself was struggling with the concept. And so thought, how would I teach it to my peers? I did. I went and got some paper lunch bags. I cut them up and I colored them up and I did a puppet show for my cytogenetics class. And my professor actually said that to me. And at that time, John, final year, I had to make a decision as to what my career was going to be. Was I going to go into medical genetics, wait another year until the program arrived in Vancouver, or do I carry on with my life else? And so when he said that to me at the end of class, plus I got an A, I left his classroom, walked down the stairs, walked across campus, and went right to the Bachelor of Education faculty. Wow. And picked up my application. Right then and there, I thought, you know what? This opportunity, somehow it came naturally to me at the time. I know we have to work hard as being teachers, but it was just something that I naturally would do for others, is teach in that way, right? So I thought this could be a career. And needless to say, I applied. I was short a few credits for that, but they still let me in. And I ended up graduating at the top of my class. So it was meant to be.
So you had never thought of teaching before that moment? Was that, I mean, had it crossed your mind before?
It crossed my mind. It was just something I was doing as part of my volunteer work, like at my parish. My brother and I, we taught PrEP. PrEP is the parish religious education program for students who don't get the opportunity to go to Catholic school. So for a number, I'm talking about 15 years, since we were teenagers ourselves, we would volunteer in our parish as the grade 6 PrEP teachers. And we would tag team together, my brother and I, just because that's what we do. I mean, our parents raised us to be active in our church, whether we're altar servers, choir members, lectors. So we have to be active. And so he and I, we both just did it because that's what we do. We volunteer and we do this. And he was on a path to become a lawyer. And I was going to be on a path to become a medical geneticist. And lo and behold, we both became educators and he married an educator. And we're just a family of educators. It's just something that we just did and had a lot of fun doing it and didn't find it as difficult.
Well, you talk about, you just mentioned it in passing there, that your parents had kind of raised you both to be active. You know, tell us a little bit about what was faith like in the home for you?
Oh, my goodness. So I was raised by converts to the faith, both of them. My father converted to Catholicism when he was sent to boarding school after his own father passed away. So both my parents were born on the island of Fiji. Yeah. And so my grandmother had so many children to take care of. So the eldest siblings of the 15, 7 of them went off to boarding school, were raised by the Marist sisters from Ireland. They came over to Fiji and they raised them. And being in that culture, my father then converted to Catholicism when he was in grade 7. And then my mother became a Catholic on the day of her wedding. So she converted to the faith, and on her wedding day, she received a number of sacraments. Not only her marriage was a sacrament, but also baptism and confirmation and Holy Communion, all on the same day. So my mother always said, like, talk about getting a workout with your out here. So it was one sorry for like 4 different events on one day. So I was raised by people whose faith comes first and foremost, to the point though, my parents made, Jonathan, so many sacrifices for my family in terms of education is one. So they immigrated to Canada. I go, we're going to give the best for our kids. So we're going to leave behind stability and a home and relatives and go off on our own and become and go to Canada because we think that's where the best opportunity for education will be. The second thing is, in terms of the center of our lives and our being, our parents always made church first and foremost, to the point, Jonathan, that of the 5 or 6 homes that I've lived in, we've never lived more than 5 minutes across from a church. Oh, yeah. It's our parents' thing is, you know what? Church is going to be center, and there's no excuse for as individuals for us to go to church, to the point where we lived literally across the street from my parish for a number of years. Our priest gave us the keys to the church so we can open it up in the mornings. That's how close we were. And so my parents invested in our education and in our family by bringing us to Canada and making church physically the center of our lives. So that's basically how it's where it began with them.
It must have been hard for them leaving behind that terrible weather in Fiji and going to Vancouver, right?
They're just like, you know what? Climatized well to our we like our cold. Multiple seasons, not just hot and hotter.
Have you been back to Fiji much?
I've only had the opportunity to go back in the year 2000. It was the year after I became a Canadian citizen. Wow. So my mother and my brother and myself, to celebrate that, we went back with our Canadian passports back to the place where I was born. And it was lovely to see that my home was still there, the parish where I was baptized, the priest who baptized me was there, Jonathan. Wow. I got to meet Father Vincent Batchelor, who apparently, and I got a sense of it, was a saint on earth. So I had a chance to meet him as well. So I was privileged in the year 2000 to go back.
So you come to Vancouver and you go to primary school at St. Mary's. And I asked somebody the other day, tell us about your first memories of Catholic primary school.
Well, when we first arrived, we were on a waiting list to get us into Catholic school. So what happened is I transferred in my grade 4 year, and my brother came when he was in his grade 1 year. So when we went into elementary school, that was then St. Mary's. My first experience of it, because it was literally across the street, it was just an extension of home. When I was raised by my family and by my parish into who I was, it was 24/7 being wrapped up in the faith. So I would go to school, and whatever was happening there was direct alignment with what was going on in my home. So if I'm going to Mass with my school, then it complements that I was going to Mass with my family on Sundays. It was like there was no distinction between my home and my school life. I mean, physically we're a block apart, but there was no distinction. So my earliest recollection was just, now we had a uniform to wear, which was the coolest. I just didn't see a difference between my life at home and my life at school.
So explain, though, that many, many young people would push back against that. Like we was it a cultural thing? Was it that your parents were just loving people? Some people would have pushed back, would have gone, this is too much. Mm-hmm. So I'm too immersed. How do you explain to yourself the fact that you didn't find this to be an imposition or a burden?
I guess, Jonathan, I think you described it right at the start of it, is that I was really raised by very faithful, loving people who came to know Jesus later in their life, and they committed wholeheartedly to him so that he was part of my family.
Right.
And so it wasn't odd for me to, I'm sorry, I feel like I want to cry because it wasn't odd to me to be 24 in this faith community.
Yeah.
I don't know why I never pushed back because I found such solace in it. I mean, it wasn't that we were perfect as a, you know, there was also, I mean, it was a typical family. We were below the poverty line, unfortunately. But I didn't know that because my family lived such rich lives that I were poor, first of all. And so that was also, I think, a part of it is that my family was able to raise me with my church and with my school because we were limited in our own resources as well, right? I didn't know that until very late in life. And so when it comes then to living such quote unquote happy, they showed me outside of my home where to find peace, outside of my home, where else to find happiness, right? And so having time in church, having peace and quiet, it was just a matter of things for us.
It was just the center. Yeah, no, it explains it. It explains it beautifully. I noticed you use the word solace. And is that some of your early memories, like just being in church and experiencing? Because often, so much of the time I talked about, one of the things our young people don't get at this cultural moment is much of an experience of the transcendent, of silence, of stillness. Was that a big part of what you experienced? That just contemplative experience?
Yes. And there was a practical reason why I got to experience it, in that my mother, and God rest her soul, my mother, when we lived across the street from the church, as I've said often, but so much so that even if we lived across the street, my mother needed to be in church before Mass started for two reasons. One is to be there to get her pew. You know how some Catholics are, right? She needs a pew.
I'm so that Catholic. That's me.
So we got to get our pew. So we got to be in our pew. And also to have that solid hour or so to be in quiet. And so I grew up coming to Mass, being the first people in church, and you sit. And she was not one for talking in church unless someone's talking to you. And that's usually the priest, right? Yeah. So we would come and we would sit. And I belong to such beautiful parishes where there's such lovely things that, you know, attract your young person's eyes, right? And, you know, there were statues and things to light. And it was just being in God's house and just having that silence, to the point that sometimes when things got rough, or, you know, like as you're growing up and things just get kind of haywire, I found that coming to church was that 1 hour of peace where I could be, I didn't have to be distracted, didn't have to worry. I just left everything at the door, and you just walk in and you sit. And I think that's a lot to do with my mother. She trained me just to enjoy that time.
Wow. So let me ask you this. Listening to how you've experienced parish life, church life, the life of faith, and your natural appreciation and gratitude, how have you dealt over the years when there's challenges in the church or challenges in a parish? How have you dealt with difficult situations? You know, I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, often when I'm doing staff seminars, a lot of teachers who haven't had a lot of formation kind of conflate the mystical church, the body of Christ, with the humans in it.
Yes.
And when you do that, and humans have a habit, of course, you and I don't, but you know, other humans have a habit of not being perfect. So, well, I guess what I'm asking you, Rose, is how have you managed to deal with difficult moments in the church or in parish life? Have you just rolled with it? How have you navigated that?
Okay, that's a really great question. I feel like we have to pause for a little bit for Rose to collect her thoughts. Okay, so for myself, Jonathan, as I'm thinking about that question, oftentimes it's to roll with the punches. I mean, realizing that it's the small C church made of people and the big C church of God. And I think because of my activity in parish life, even to this day, I'm liturgy coordinator for my parish, and I'm part of a number of groups that are doing numerous things to support our parish life. It's funny. I always found the humor in it. My brother says that, Rose, you're like a professional lemonade maker. But again, I was raised by a person who just taught me to find the silver lining and to roll with the punches. So when it comes to the small C church, it's a great resource for laughter, for smiles. I guess something that I haven't had to worry too much about. I've been blessed, Jonathan, but I can't offer much advice other than what I find very useful for me is when it means to connect to church is sit in the front pew, so you're not distracted by anybody.
I tell you the truth, the biggest revelation we've had as a family is, because I love beautiful liturgy and stillness and silence. And, you know, we had three children under the age of 3.5 at one point. So our kids have always been very close in age. And for a long time, we were going to a parish, and it was just a zoo. And my kids, we would always sit in the back row, because that was the way you could get out before one of your kids broke something or did something horrendous. But then about 2 years ago, I just made a decision with Karen, and we took them to the cathedral. And we have sat in the front row of the cathedral every single Sunday at 8 a.m. for the last 2.5 years. And the impact on my kids has been amazing. My little boy, like, he sits there and he just looks around. And we had the Easter Triduum this year, and, I got there like an hour. I was like a Navy SEAL, you know, scoping out the environment. I got there an hour early, and I was like pushing old ladies out of the way and got to the front row and ignoring red lights and stop signs. Anyway, but to be there in the front row, you know, when all the stuff's happening and the incense and the singing, and my kids were just like, you're not, you know, 20 rows back looking at someone's hairstyle, or how could they come to church wearing that shirt, you know, none of that sort of stuff. So I hear you. I guess it's a question of, you know, there was some advice I once got about marriage, which was to enter marriage with both eyes open, wide open, and then afterwards to keep them both half shut. It was like, so I think with the church, it's a bit like that. Sometimes we probably do need to just overlook some things and be more patient with each other. So let me ask you a related question, which is this.
Sure.
With all that you do, and from a young age, you've been kind of volunteering and doing so much stuff. How do you not get tired? Now, obviously, you've got a personality that's quite ebullient and energetic, and your professional.
I'm liking that word.
It's a great word, isn't it? Ebullient.
I'm going to have to change my Twitter profile. Thank you.
I'm going
to
put that in the show notes. How have you not got tired? And this relates to all the Catholic teachers listening, and it's something I talk about in every podcast. What keeps you going?
Okay, Jonathan, so I might have to let you in on a secret. What keeps me going? Okay, Wow, Jonathan, I feel like I have to write my obituary now.
It's not vodka or something, is it? Or
no, but this is, you know, this is, you have no idea how many times I've been asked that question, what keeps me going. And I used to say to people, I find myself to be like a pinwheel. Are you familiar with that little toy called a pinwheel?
No.
Okay. Well, if you Google the word pinwheel, a pinwheel is a toy that if you place it in wind, it flutters and spins on its own. So I've often said to people that what keeps me going is the people around me, and that as a pinwheel, if I'm not in the presence of the wind, let's say the Holy Spirit or people's spirits who are just so infectious, if I'm not in a place that's spinning my pinwheel, then I'm not who I am. I will seek out places and people and spaces that are going to spin my pinwheel, to say the least, right? Wow. So that's one way I describe it to people. So I seek out those spaces. And I found that being in a classroom, being with children, spins my pinwheel. When I'm working with my parish, with people who are so committed, who are so selfless, and they sacrifice so much so that others can come closer to God in this world, why am I not going to be excited to be around them? Sure. When I am working with teachers who are pushing themselves and risk takers and trying to do the very best for their kids, how can I not be excited? And so that's one way that I describe it to them. Another way, in terms of where do I get this energy from? It's almost like I'm a chameleon. And so if I was a chameleon and sitting... And so depending upon the temperature of where I am, I'm either dead or near dead, or I'm actually alive in color. And so when I'm around individuals whose energies are lifting me up, it just causes me to spin faster, to light up. Right. So I find that's one way that I do it. Another way is that, again, Jonathan, the person who's speaking to you now, I've been conditioned over a number of decades because of being raised by a family and by a parish that gave me a prescription for rose-colored glasses. Like, I was brought up to be able to sit in the front pew, and if I needed to crawl out of the front pew and dance on the altar, which I did when I was a child, that was totally okay. Let Rose dance on the altar, and I've done that. If I'm intentional about finding this, because the more and more that I come to realize my role to bring other people to God, this idea of sanctity and salvation, and that my role as a teacher, for example, is not just to get students to graduate with a transcript. My role is to see them in heaven. One day I'm going to open the door to the gates of heaven for them, right? Like, knowing that is in the back of my mind every waking moment, that these individuals are going, that I'm going to have to see them again. And I always find that there are adults that I might not necessarily connect with here, but I always worry that God might make me bunk with them in heaven. So I better clear things up now with them here, or he might force me to live with them for eternity and work it out there. So I don't know, John, if I've answered your question, but I'm privileged because I'm single as well. So I'm able to give more of myself outside of my family connection. I can connect with more people because I am single. I've got the single vocation, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm able to find more and more people to spin my pinwheel, to say the least.
Wow. Look, I want to pick up on something you just alluded to, and it's something you wrote in your notes that really caught my attention. It's about sort of about vocation, and listening to what you just said, it almost as if as a child, both in your family and your church community, you were kind of given mm-hmm. permission to be who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas for many of us, we grow up for complex reasons trying to be what we think people want us to be. Now, mm-hmm. there's a line you wrote here where you said, it's a quote from Thomas Merton, which I think is brilliant. You said, therefore, yes, the problem of sanctity and salvation is in fact the problem of finding out who I am and discovering mm-hmm. my true self.
Mm-hmm.
How does that play out in Catholic education? When a Catholic school is doing its job well, speak to that concept of vocation, sanctity, salvation being this mm-hmm. process of discovering who mm-hmm. we are.
I think, Jonathan, that connects directly to one of our newest initiatives in the work that I'm doing here with the Catholic Independent Schools here in Vancouver, is the Vision for Learning Initiative, where we're committing fully to helping our students be seekers of truth, beauty, and goodness. And in hopes that they will become saints in the making, right? Like you've said that so often to us, yeah. Jonathan, that we're saint factories. Yeah. And claiming that we are saint factories, if we are to then hold to the definition of Thomas Merton, if we're going to help students become saints, our role as educators is to help students understand who God made them to be, is to, for them to realize their passion, to realize their potential, to realize their path beyond just being people who contribute to society in terms of career. Yeah. We want children to know a greater purpose. We want them to seek that happiness. And so when I'm looking at the work that we're doing in our schools, especially in BC, this is why I'm so beside myself with the changes that are happening in curriculum, in the secular curriculum, is the secular curriculum has opened up these same conversations. Are our students as individuals realizing their uniqueness? Even in some of the ministry documents, they speak of the uniqueness and the giftedness of our children. Do they know who they are, what they are, and for what purpose they are here? How can they contribute not just to society as in terms of the economy, but can they contribute to making it a better society? I always say it's not about helping students live in a changing world. It's to help our students change the world. So there's been some section between secular curriculum and the call of Catholic education in the last 3 or 4 years that I'm beside myself, Jonathan. It's just right now for us to capitalize on it.
So the outside perspective, my understanding was that there was a fair bit of pressure coming on in Canada in terms of government almost intervention in Catholic education. But are you saying that there's actually a simultaneous kind of opportunity?
Yes.
So what is that? Because when you talked a moment ago about the ministry documents, the government documents are talking about potential and giftedness.
Yes.
Is that a case of like the echoes of Christian culture still resonating in secular culture, or is it something else? How do you read that?
Well, I know that when the curriculum was being revised, it was a worldwide, based on worldwide studies, and we resurrected the hidden curriculum school, which was the core competencies. And I think in Australia, they're called them.
We call them KLAs sometimes, key learning areas, that sort of stuff. Yeah.
What we've done is we've highlighted, unlike in years past, the hidden curriculum of school. For what purpose does school exist? And it's not just for the purpose of, it's for students to come to know who they are. I mean, even Dr. Sharon Jarowski, who is one of the lead researchers on this, she points out that it's all about story. It's all about knowing who you are and who you're becoming, which again parallels Thomas Merton. We've actually now, through the core competencies, our schools are now wholeheartedly focused, public, independent, or otherwise, on helping students grow into creative, critical thinkers who are personally and socially responsible and effective communicators. And if you dig deep into those definitions, they're asking students to know who you are. Where do you find balance? And where are your communities? Who are you connected to? What enables you to think critically? Are you benefiting society? How are you adding to the world? How are you contributing? And so they're asking questions that are similar to the questions that we're hoping our students will answer through Catholic education, is how are you contributing to the bigger world, right?
So imagine Catholic teachers listening to this, and we've talked about this. Sanctity and salvation is the problem of finding out who I am and discovering my true self. Mm-hmm. My take of the last sort of few years has been the intensity of many of our schools, the pressures from government, the pressures from parents. Mm-hmm. How does a teacher listening to this navigate what you're saying? How do they – on one level they'll be going, sure, we've got to help kids to know who they are. How do they do it? How do they – listening to you, what can you offer them in terms of their practice, their paradigms of this bigger vision of what they're actually doing?
So when I'm working with our schools, whether it's our independent schools here in Vancouver or the rest of the province, I ask them to approach the core competencies by looking first at their mission and vision statement. So I will always I will always do some research. I'll go onto their website, wherever, if I'm doing a workshop for school, and I'll bring up their mission vision statement. And more often than not, Jonathan, it always points to these larger goals for school. Students will come to become better people. They will come to our schools and become critical, creative thinkers, and on we go, right? I will always bring that up first. I go, this is why you have school. We're not here. It doesn't say we're going to make test takers. It doesn't say we're going to make cogs for the economic machine. It doesn't say that. It says, and they use such beautiful language. I mean, I've read so many mission and vision statements. And I go, well, now let's look at the core competencies. Is this not the same language? It's the same sentiments, different words. Now what we're doing is we're just holding to what we've always offered to all of our parents and to society, that we are here to produce citizens who are going to be contributing to society. And but as Catholic schools, we offer it one step bigger, citizen saints. And so when I'm working with the teachers, I say to them, let's hold to your mission and vision. Now let's treat the core competencies as if we're going to teach a language to our students. And if you're a language teacher, how do you introduce language? And so they always offer, like, we create posters, and Rose will do posters. We'll be intentional in putting that language in use in our classrooms. We'll have it plastered on boards. And I go, yes, perfect. You're going to actually say it out loud. The purpose for you learning this is not just to get a grade, but it's actually going to grow you into a better person. You're going to do this. And so we're getting teachers to be more intentional and visual so that students can then internalize it, so that they can verbalize it. And so we've taken such steps here in this province that this self-assessment, like, we want our students to see their growth as human beings, is actually now part of their final report cards. Wow. We're asking students to, with evidence, show how they have grown into better communicators, better people who are socially and personally responsible, people who are creative and critical thinkers. Look back at your year that you've spent in school, outside of school. And so now we've elevated it to the point where it's everyone's priority. So this is how teachers are doing it in their schools.
So let me ask you, one of the challenges we have here in Australia is, it's almost as if a lot of parents don't actually want this. They will say they do. If you were to say to them, hey, do you want your child to be a critical thinker, a good communicator, a good citizen? They go, yeah, of course we do. But the way they actually allocate resources and the schools that they're choosing still seem to be around that economic model. It's like, show me the school that has the best academic reputation. So how do you navigate this at a moment in educational history and cultural history where there's a lot of conflicted desires here? Like, people are like, yeah, we want that, but what we really want is this. And you're a real evangelist for this. But it's funny because as you talk and you talk about your parents coming from a Marist background, there's a beautiful line from Marcelin Champagne, who I always quote it, and he says that what we must do is create good Christians and good citizens. Like, even back in the 18th century, he knew that this was the goal. So I guess what I'm asking you is, as an evangelist for this bigger vision of education, well, you are. I mean, you're passionate about it, and you.
I am.
And you should be. How do you deal with the resistance and the people that are stuck in that mindset of, no, really what matters is pure academic excellence, the best possible academic reputation, then we can get kids into college? How do you bring people with you?
Well, Jonathan, I'll say first, I wish you asked me this in about 5 years from now, because we're starting with this too. And I'm finding that what's happening is that the conversations are happening. We haven't had this level or depth of conversation before. Like, we're actually redefining returning to what school should be. And we're actually reclaiming it beyond being a factory just for academics. And so we're finding that these conversations, we're bringing in more people to discern what's going on. And so I'm finding that when parents are asking, you know, I need to go to a school with high academic yield and such, we're finding that there's, like, post-secondary evangelists, people who are working in the post-secondary institutions, who are saying that, no, actually, we want students who are creative, critical thinkers. We want students who are not just going to do well on a test, but who can do well in the test of life. We're inviting into the conversation, especially here in BC, some of these worldwide experts like Dr. Yang Zhao, who just visited with some parents in Richmond and in one of our suburbs. And he's advocating like what the world needs is unique, original thinkers. We don't need machines. We have machines. And so we need to create schools that are going to cultivate this, because otherwise your child will be replaced by a machine. We want your students to grow and contribute. And if they don't know how unique they are, then we are not going to be able to enter into this unknown future.
That is such an interesting distinction. I hadn't really heard it expressed like that. I know that the liberal arts tradition, like in Australia, there is actually only one liberal arts college in the entire nation.
Wow.
And because it's very new here, it's very much a North American thing. And I mean, so we don't, and the reason I bring this up is because there's a fair bit of data around that. A lot of big corporations are actually turning their attention to liberal arts graduates because they tend to have this much more rounded, holistic, philosophical way of thinking, rather than just I can crank a spreadsheet and you know, where's my cubicle. So I think it's interesting. I hadn't heard it expressed as compellingly as you are expressing
it. And that actually, it's interesting that you say about the liberal arts, and in that many of our high schools, let's say our high schools, our secondary schools, are revisiting the design of their school out in terms of subject areas. Instead of having silos of like math and then science and then English, they're trying to recreate that liberal arts theme such that it's humanities. It's going to be a block of time in which you learn about English, social studies, and Christian education all together through STEM, using science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So you're doing real life applications by doing integrated studies.
Yeah.
So some of our schools are now modeling that approach, because in that way you create problem solvers. In that way you create people who are thinking critically and not just spewing out an algorithm. Right. So they're trying to recreate that real life experience in their schools.
And also, again, listening to you, I think the Catholic approach to things like contemplation, silence and stillness, you know, what possible application could that have? I mean, apart from the work I do in Catholic education, I do a lot of high-end executive coaching, business consultancy. And the big skill, the one that's kind of most really that's most lucrative, is the ability to really listen and just be with someone. And if I look at even the Catholic approach to stillness, to prayer, to contemplation, a school that can help students to listen, you know, a school that can help students pause and be reflective. So just talking to you, I'm actually becoming quite convinced. I have a personal interest. My eldest daughter, who's now 10, she had quite a bit of trouble at some of her at the school she was at. We eventually had to move her, and now she's just so happy. And she goes to this school, and it changed our whole family. Like, we got our lives back, and she got her life back. But so many days I say, oh, what did you do today? She goes, oh, we had heaps of fun. And I go, but what did you do? And she goes, well, we did this, and we and it's just like, you know, there's a continuum here, right? But but she's actually, I'm observing that what they're doing here is building a beautiful community of staff and students. And she wants to be there. You know, she wants to learn.
So on
that sort of stuff, let me ask you a question. It sounds like it's circling back, but I think it's a really important one. In the depths of your being, this is a surface question. Why do Catholic schools exist? Why do you think they exist? What's their purpose?
Jonathan, why do they exist? Well, Jonathan, if you had asked the question of my parents, they exist to help me grow in my faith. If that was going to be if you're asking that question for my parents, Catholic schools exist so that my child can grow in their faith. You're asking a teacher from a classroom right now. Catholic schools exist so that when my students leave me, they're going to enter this world bringing Jesus into it.
through their actions and through every decision that they make. They're going to see things differently. They're going to want to make things different. They're going to do the little things that are going to make other people's lives better. They're going to be better people for it because they're going to bring Jesus into the world. That's why I think Catholic schools exist, so that Jesus can be present in this world.
Amen. And it's the depth of my being.
This is why they exist, to be Jesus and to one day meet him.
Well, listening to you, it's like the gospel itself is transformative of culture. And if Catholic schools can do what you're talking about, when lots of individuals become who they're meant to be, mm-hmm. and they're more integrated and more capable of love, then culture shifts. So this is why mm-hmm. I think Catholic schools play such an integral role mm-hmm. in the evangelization of culture. So I guess everybody listening, I always try to say to teachers that these tiny things that you think no one sees, these individual conversations,
the little
things. Okay, so I'm going to ask a couple of final questions. I wanted to ask you, my personal area of interest is always around burnout, cynicism, and fatigue. Now, talking to you, like that's not a huge part of your experience, but for so many teachers around the world and very much has been here in this country, the system can make people mm-hmm. tired. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I wanted to talk to you and ask your insights on how can people go the distance? What sort of practices around personal spirituality, self-care, what are some of the key things that can mm-hmm. help people listening not just survive but actually thrive in the Catholic education vocation? What are some of the things that people need to be thinking about?
Well, when I'm – Jonathan, so this question – especially when I'm working with our newest teachers, right? Those who are coming into their first year working in our system, and you meet them in August and you meet them throughout the year, and hopefully they're still going to be with you at the end. When I'm working with them, I ask them, you know, about keeping yourselves connected and happy. Like, what's going to make them interesting to their students, right? Yeah. And I find that if I was going to give any new teacher advice, it's like, make sure that you make a great weekend. Like I always tell them, make a great day or make a great weekend. It's up to you to decide to do that. And I always say, you know, what makes you happy and do it and then come. And that's what you're going to bring. Like if you're a better human being, right? And so personally for myself, I find what helps me recharge, because I do, Jonathan, it's not 24/7. I do, you know, sleep helps, but what helps me recharge is time by myself. And I enjoy, as much as I enjoy babbling to you and talking, I enjoy writing. I enjoy writing. I find writing to be very, very therapeutic. And when my mother had passed away, very healing. Wow. I'm healing myself through writing and remembering her. And then parallel that to my own blog that I have for teachers is I like to write about the small things, things that people would miss the first time around, you know, the little joys, right? Yeah. And I find that brings me back to life. I find that sometimes you need a really good laugh. Sometimes you need to be around people who love you for all your foibles, right? It's make time for yourself. And that, for me, is helping me personally. But again, a better person to ask that question would be my former English language arts teacher. He retired last year after 54 years of teaching.
What?